From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Happy Thanksgiving. It's here and now. The deadly campfire in California has been burning for 2 weeks today. The wildfire is now 90% contained, but it has burned more than 153,000 acres and killed at least 83 people. Rain has brought relief for some firefighters still battling the wildfire, but it has also complicated efforts to recover victims' remains. John Sepulvedo is a reporter with KQED. He joins us now from Chico, California. John, welcome and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Jeremy.
So California and where you are in California has been getting some rain. What is that doing to all of the efforts that are going on?
Well, for firefighting efforts, it's been great because the rain is bringing much needed relief. There's still about 10% that needs to be contained, but that means that there are over 100 miles that need to be dug into the dirt, that need to be essentially barricaded from this fire by using mounds of dirt and clearing brush and things like that. And that's a lot of mileage. So this rain is a really, really needed and welcomed relief for those firefighters. It's also welcomed and needed for people who've been breathing the air the past couple weeks, because from San Francisco to San Jose to Shasta, which is like going up from essentially, you know, Washington, D.C., almost all the way to New York, there has been this thick yellow-gray haze mm-hmm. of smoke and particles, and it has made it so difficult for so many people to breathe. The air has been at various times some of the worst in the world because of this fire, and the rain has taken that away too. The only thing that people are worried about right now in California because of the rain is that it could lead to either mud flows, landslides, and other things, because, you know, when fire comes and it takes away all of the tree structure and all the vegetation structure, it makes that mound of dirt much, much more likely to move. So when the rain comes, it can push that earth. And that can be a nightmare for people who are still living in some of these areas. So far, I've not heard of, as of Thanksgiving, I've not heard of any massive mud flows mm-hmm. or flash floods. But we know that there's a flash flood warning in this area until at least Friday because of this rain.
The other worry is that for people who are still looking for the missing, and there are more than 500 still considered missing, that the rain is going to make it harder to find remains.
Most definitely. And it's already hard. So, Jeremy, I don't know how to explain it. I've covered, unfortunately, so many natural disasters. I've never seen anything like this where really thick steel has burned. I mean, it's got to be really hot for steel to burn. It's already very difficult to find remains in a situation where it was such a hot inferno that blazed for so long. And we heard from survivors who described it as something that they would have saw in a film about warning about atom bombs when they were young, or something that they would have seen in a Hollywood movie about the end of the world. I mean, it was that hot and that intense. So it's already tough. But then when you have rain come in and kind of sweep over these areas of this already very kind of barren hellscape where there's nothing but debris and the potential for remains there, it's going to make it more difficult for folks who are looking for this. And that's why they're doing their best, even on Thanksgiving. I've confirmed yesterday that on Thanksgiving, people are still going door to door with cadaver dogs, with other instruments to find human remains, mm-hmm. because it's a real race against time.
John, you're in Chico, which is a city where many people who have fled Paradise and other areas that were very hard hit have gone for shelter. It's so difficult to get a hotel that you're actually staying in somebody's home there. But right. What about the people who have lost their homes or who aren't able to go back to their homes at this moment? Are you still surrounded by those people who've come in from Paradise and Magalia and other places?
Yeah. I mean, there's one of the really cool things about this story, and it's kind of like picking, you know, these really beautiful moments in this really horrific act. But the community has opened up their house, and not just here, from the Bay Area to San Jose, up to far away as Eugene, Oregon. People have been opening up their houses to strangers because there are no shelters and there are no hotels. I mean, the entire town was burned. There's really nowhere to go. More than 16,000 structures. And so that's been one of the real, like, uplifting human angles of this is just how generous people have been with their space to complete strangers. the really sad part of this is that there's another I mean, Jeremy, look, I don't want to bag on FEMA. It's in some cases it's really easy to do, but FEMA has been wholly insufficient based on the reporting in providing shelters and providing contingencies. They have not been reaching out and giving correct information. They've really put the onus on the survivors to kind of figure their way out. We've heard anecdotes of people trading all the gas cards and other charity items they're getting to be able to get temporary housing and the very few hotel spaces that are available in the Tri-County area. And when we talked to FEMA, we actually talked to FEMA yesterday, they weren't able to answer basic questions. They weren't really able to explain why we can get tent encampments up for migrant children along the border, but we can't do that here. And there's a deep frustration with FEMA that they haven't done anything to provide trailers, provide shelters, essentially, you know, perform their mandate as chartered by Congress.
Well, hopefully they are listening and people can get the help that they need a little bit faster. John Sepulvedo in Chico, California, reporter with KQED covering the aftermath of the campfire. John, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Well, more than 8 million acres of forest have burned in the U.S. this year. And as the wildfire season grows longer, hotter, and more unpredictable, there is more attention to the destruction fires cause in lost lives, destroyed homes, and businesses. But scientists are learning that many plants and animals need fire to survive. Aaron Scott from Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
The trekking poles are helping my old man bones.
Ecologists Paul Hesburgh and Bill Gaines are walking through a section of the Cascade Mountains in Washington State. A large fire in 2006 left the mountainsides here covered in charred, dead trees, kind of like a giant cellulose pincushion.
Paul, I'm not seeing a lot of woodpecker cavity activity in here.
I haven't seen a cavity all morning or heard any banging.
The reason we're looking for woodpeckers is that they are a poster animal for how scientists like Gaines and Hesburgh are reimagining wildfire. Instead of seeing fire as a negative thing that needs to be suppressed, they are finding it is essential to the well-being of many plants and animals. For example, burned forests may look barren to us, but for wood-eating insects and their predators, they are a feast waiting to happen. Gaines marvels at how woodpeckers just seem to flock in.
One thing we don't really know is there's got to be like some woodpecker hotline where they're like, come on, everybody, there's a lot of food. Let's get together and eat.
And they are far from alone. From aspen to morels, from black bears to bees, there's an incredible range of plants and animals that thrive in areas touched by fire. One of the best known examples is the lodgepole pine, which grows what's called serotonous cones.
And so every cone scale is held together by a drop of resin. And it takes the heat of a fire to melt that resin and cause those cone scales to open up.
The cones shed seeds that quickly grow into dense stands of young trees. And these stands are one of the only hunting grounds for one of the country's most adorable and threatened predators, the Canada lynx.
Okay, so we're going to pretend we're a cat. We're going to pretend we're a Canada lynx. And what we want to find is our prize food, the snowshoe hare.
Gaines crouches down and stalks his way through the thick branches.
You can see here a scat from a snowshoe hare, so we know they've been here. Tells us this is good habitat for snowshoe hare and good habitat for lynx.
That's because these young pines are like a Goldilocks zone. They're just right. Big enough to provide shelter for the bunnies, with branches low enough to hide under. But as the pines grow taller and their branches stop touching the ground, the bunnies and the lynx that hunt them have to go in search of new stands. As Hesburgh explains it, few Western animals have evolved to live in thick, unchanging forests. Instead, most need an evolving, clumpy mosaic of landscapes to meet all their needs. And the main driver behind that constant process of change and renewal is fire.
If you were to roll the film back 100, 150 years in history and take a look at a big landscape panorama, what you would see is places that were burned yesterday, places that were burned 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that create this variety of habitats.
But decades of fire suppression have transformed that landscape.
Where the forest has all grown up and blended, there are some critters still making a living in that landscape, but it has nowhere near the variety of the former landscape before it was homogenized.
Today's thick forests, combined with a warming climate, also set the stage for megafires. The result is two starkly contrasting landscapes and a dynamic far different from the one native animals evolved with. Gaines says the loss of that varied habitat for creatures like the Canada lynx has been devastating.
Lynx recovery is either made or not here in this part of Washington. This is the largest population in the lower 48 states.
And it doesn't stop there. Fire has a crazy interaction with water. By helping to thin out dense spreading forests, it actually leads to more water flowing into wetlands and streams. That encourages rich, cool dining rooms for everything from deer to fish. No one is advocating that we let all fires burn freely, especially the human-caused ones. But a consensus is emerging that, as crazy as it sounds, we need to restore regular fire to the land to help our fellow plants and animals survive. For Here and Now, I'm Aaron Scott.
On this Thanksgiving Day, we welcome our friends at the weekly podcast Backstory to talk about a very appropriate topic, the history of stuffing. Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers are historians and co-hosts of Backstory. Welcome back.
Thanks very much.
Good to be here.
Now, I think there may have been a breakdown in communication. I thought that we were going to be talking about stuffing recipes for Thanksgiving, but no, you are here to talk about the history of taxidermy in America, a very different kind of stuffing.
And yet it is stuffing, right? We can agree on that, right?
So what have you got for us about that?
Well, it's a pretty amazing story, actually. Let's think about, there's a painting that people may have seen by Charles Wilson Peale, and he's showing you his museum, actually, there in Boston. And it's a self-portrait. And he's an older guy, and he pulls back the curtain, gazes right into your eyes, and shows you what's in his museum. And what it is a stuffed American eagle, and on the floor, an American turkey awaiting to be stuffed in a taxidermy type. But it turns out that he had bigger ambitions for his taxidermy than just these birds. He wrote to a group of civic leaders that he invited to serve on a committee of directors for his museum. And this pretty impressive board had people, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, you may have heard of. But I don't think they'd ever seen a proposal quite like the one he put before him.
What do you mean?
Well, he proposed that it would be a great idea to stuff people like, say, Ben Franklin.
What?
And by implication, themselves.
Some people felt he already was stuffed, Ed. That's the thing. He would be double stuffed.
He was the opposite of stuffy, Brian. And so his idea would be, you know, these guys are so great. Wouldn't it be wonderful if subsequent generations could cast their eyes upon their greatness, looking the way that they really do? And he says there's this new form that he's actually a pioneer in of using arsenic to be able to keep animals almost indefinitely. So he thought, well, if it was great for stuffing birds, wouldn't it be great for stuffing luminaries? So he was regretting that he forgot to mention this to Ben Franklin before he died. But fortunately, he had these guys before him and thought maybe they'd be interested. They weren't.
You know, these days they do this with like holograms of people. It seems a little less morbid than actually stuffing the person, but good thing for consent. Otherwise, we'd be looking at all the founding fathers, stuffed in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, Peale unfortunately had to settle for stuffing Franklin's Angora cat and a couple of golden pheasants that belonged to George Washington.
What a letdown.
Oh. So it sounds like a weird idea, but it turns out that other people have had the same idea. If you go to Russia, you can see Lenin, or you can go to Vietnam and see Ho Chi Minh, or China and see Chairman Mao, and they're all on display and stuff. And you could argue that going to Madame Tussauds' life-size waxworks is kind of a similar thing. But the real inspiration for Peale was an English philosopher, Jerry Bentham, whose preserved body, and this just sounds like a great idea, is wheeled out for committee meetings at University College London.
My God.
Wouldn't that give a certain air of gravity to your deliberation?
That just makes no sense at all. But isn't most taxidermy about an elk or a deer or something like that, or a bear?
Yes, or a bird. Maybe even a bird that's a literary character.
Who are you talking about?
Well, just listen up. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor, Jeremy," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more." All right.
Okay.
All right. So what
listeners,
kind of bird? What kind of bird would that
are
be?
Are we talking about a raven, perhaps?
You are on fire.
500 points for Jeremy.
You are on fire. Well, that raven, the actual raven that inspired that poetry or novel, as it may be, is sitting stuffed on a log in the rare books department
really?
Of the Philadelphia Free Library.
The exact
as
raven.
We speak, the exact
yep.
raven. Now here's the thing. You're not going to believe this, Jeremy, but that raven was really Charles Dickens' raven.
Huh.
And I mean that quite literally. Dickens wrote a novel called Barnaby Rudge, and the novel featured his pet raven, Grip. Right? Poe gets involved in this story because Poe wrote a review of Barnaby Rudge, and he kind of liked it, but he said, you know, Dickens could have done a lot more with that raven. And wouldn't you know it, that Edgar Allan Poe did. So he wrote The Raven. The Raven became very famous, but the raven was no longer alive. The raven suffered a terrible fate, and Dickens was so attached to that raven that when the raven died, he had an autopsy performed. I'm not making this up. It was probably lead chips and lead paint poisoning that did in the raven. So anyway, the raven is shuttled off. He wasn't just napping. And the raven is finally auctioned off in the 20th century, and he makes the rounds, and he ends up in Philadelphia, in the Free Library of Philadelphia, in the rare book, or we really should call it the rare raven room.
You know, we humans really are just incapable of saying goodbye to things that we... It's really... What other historic animals have been preserved, by the way, while we're talking about this?
Well, you know, a raven's pretty impressive, and that's quite the literary legacy, but I've got something much larger.
Oh, always one
yeah,
up.
Yeah, well, a horse, and not just any horse, but the horse of General Stonewall Jackson of the Confederacy. And what's interesting about this horse is that he outlived his owner by 30 years and became a celebrity across the South. They'd take him around at reunions and things, and people loved Little Sorrel was his name. He wasn't actually that little, but that was in comparison to Big Sorrel that Jackson had owned. And so he lives out a great life for 30 years, and the latter years goes to the old soldiers' home in Richmond, Virginia, where the Confederate veterans help take care of him until he dies. And when he does die, he's so beloved that they get the leading taxidermist in the country from the North to come down and figure out how you might preserve Little Sorrel forever. They decide that rather than stuffing him, and I hope you'll allow me to still work this into our stuffing show, Jeremy, they put him on a plaster base. So we kind of suspend the horse's hide over this. And so it looks very realistic. And if you don't believe me, you can go to the Virginia Military Institute Museum and see it for yourself today.
Okay, so with all of this crazy history that I had never even thought of,
right?
Why do people like to stuff animals so much?
Well, I think there's a longer story here about men, and it's usually men exerting dominion over nature. It's certainly very much an American story, taming nature. And in the case of stuffing animals and the United States, it's really very much about fairly wealthy Easterners going out west, shooting these animals for sport and for fun, but also doing good at the same time by bringing them back, stuffing them, and what better than using them for educational purposes, which they did in these things called dioramas. And I'll bet you've been to one, Jeremy. I mean, I went to them as a kid. there's, you know, you've got the jungle or the forest, and there's the lion peeking out there. It's usually a darkened room, and they actually can be quite frightening to a kid. But the purpose of these dioramas at the beginning of the 20th century, like the Museum of Natural History, was to educate. So these wealthy men, think Teddy Roosevelt, for instance, go out, they're big game hunters, they shoot, they kill, but they also feel they're doing good by conserving and bringing back nature in its, quote, pristine form.
And today, taxidermy has another form. There's a sort of a new rage for taxidermy.
Really?
Yeah. There is. There's classes that you can take in most of the major cities of the country. And, you know, it's you know, the journalistic approach to is hipster taxidermy.
Yeah, you have to have a Pabst Blue Ribbon beer in order to participate.
But the idea is that they don't kill any animal for this purpose. And they pride themselves in the, sort of the artistic and creative setting of them. And sometimes doing things like, you know, putting horns on a small rodent, things like that.
Who wouldn't do that?
Exactly. So what it suggests is that, you know, humans and animals have this strange relationship that can take lots of different forms, and it's still taking new forms even today.
And if you want to be right on the cutting edge of the taxidermy revolution, buy in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. That is the new hot hipster center of taxidermy. Thanks to both of you, Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast, Backstory. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks very much.
You
Don't
too.
Get stuffed.
And pass the cranberry sauce.
Okay, keep them coming.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Fewer than half of adults in the U.S. have a will or other estate planning documents. And as many Americans gather for the holidays, now could be a good time to talk to your loved ones about a difficult but important topic. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks for joining us and happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you. And I'm very thankful for you and everyone there at Here and Now.
I am thankful for you as well. We all are. And let's talk about this tough topic. So should people be really doing this on Thanksgiving weekend?
You know, it's not a bad time. And I think it's really a delicate topic. So you don't do this at your Thanksgiving meal. But the reason why a lot of estate planning attorneys like this weekend to use as sort of a peg to get the conversation going is because families are spread out all over the country. This may be one of the few opportunities where you're face to face with a loved one and you take a walk and you talk.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that obviously would be the result of such a talk is to create a will, right? I mean, is that what you should be doing next?
Well, look, I think your first step is you want to open a conversation and say, what have you done? Because you really don't know. A lot of people haven't touched their initial estate documents for decades. So the first thing is, have you done anything? What is there? If you haven't done anything, is it time to go and talk to an attorney? Really, this conversation is not necessarily you're trying to walk away with a document. You're trying to walk away with information and then a bit of a plan of action of how you can help your loved ones get on their way. And I keep putting this in the terms of a parent, but I think a lot of parents are worried their kids haven't done this. So if you've got adult children, you should also be having these conversations because sometimes they think, well, I'm 34 years old. What do I have to worry about?
What if you don't have a will or any estate documents and then you die?
Yeah, this is not the worst thing in the world because, you know, it means you die intestate. And that means that the state of residence will determine what happens next. Now, in some cases, it can be quite complicated. And I think the biggest issue that most families face is that if you put yourself in the hands of the state determines who gets what.
Right.
And that's pretty frightening right then and there. And that has to do with not just your assets, but it can be about your children, your minor children. That's why the estate planning process is so important. You don't want to go see an attorney who did your house closing 5 years ago. An estate planning attorney is really the most important.
What if you're listening to this and saying, well, I don't have any significant wealth. It doesn't really matter.
You know, I always get this question, well, can I just do this online? Sure, you could. If you're telling me the answer is, I will either do nothing or get some pre-populated document, okay, do it online. But I would really stress that even if you don't have assets, there are other aspects of your estate planning that really is something that you need to think about. What would happen to me if I got hit by a bus tomorrow? What kind of measures would I want to have? That's called a healthcare proxy. What if I were laid up in the hospital and I had a tax inquiry? Is someone going to be my power of attorney? Who would that be? So the process is one where it's not just about, oh, I'm going to die in 40 years, but it's what would happen today if something strange happened, incapacitated me, who would I trust? How can I put the steps together that would make me feel more comfortable if that terrible event were to occur?
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. We will see if people take your advice and have this conversation this weekend. Jill, thank you so much and happy Thanksgiving again.
Thank you.
It is Thanksgiving, but that hasn't stopped the president from responding to a rebuke from Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. The rare back and forth between a sitting president and the head of the Supreme Court started earlier this week when Trump criticized a federal judge from California's Ninth Circuit who ruled against his policy on asylum for migrants. He called the judge an Obama judge. Roberts responded with a statement that, quote, "We do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges. What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal right to those appearing before them," end quote. To that, Trump tweeted that Roberts can say what he wants and should study the numbers. And today, speaking at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, where he's spending the holiday, the president called the Ninth Circuit a thorn in our side.
A judge that knows nothing about it decided to take law enforcement into his own hands, and he gives a ridiculous ruling. So we'll appeal it. But it makes the job harder. We're still doing the job perfectly. But it makes the job harder and it makes the job more dangerous. Because a judge made a ruling that was shocking. Okay?
He also tweeted today that there will be bedlam, chaos, injury, and death unless his policy stands. Supreme Court watchers say it is unlikely Roberts will respond. Well, some of our listeners might remember Robin Young's expedition to see the annual migration of the snow geese in Vermont with her late uncle Lachlan McLaughlin Field. At the time of her visit, Uncle Locke, as Robin called him, was 88 and starting his battle with Alzheimer's. He died just before Thanksgiving 2004 at the age of 91. And Robin will always treasure the memory of that visit.
The snow geese, thousands of them, touch down every fall at a refuge called Dead Creek. My Uncle Locke had taken me there once to see the brown Canadian geese, but I wanted to see the snows. My cousin Peggy kept writing this fall, telling me that the snows had arrived. Finally, I got the subtext of her postcards. The leaves were falling. The snow geese would soon be leaving. And at 88, it's not like my uncle was going to wait around forever either. So up to Vermont we went.
Uncle Locke?
Yo!
Hi!
Hey, yo!
We should go see the geese while we can.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
My uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin Field, looms large in my branch of the family. We were from the suburbs of New York. He collected arrowheads and with his son carved duck decoys. He and my late Aunt Martha spent years in the war, then came to Middlebury where he taught high school art. To us, he was General Patton meets Norman Rockwell.
I can't drive the car anymore. I haven't been out of this. I haven't seen it. You're the first person I've seen in this house in 2 weeks.
No.
That's true.
Well, hardly. It's just that at 88, Uncle Locke recently had to give up cross-country skiing. He's not painting as much.
Sit around. Vegetate.
Not today. We're going to geese.
What, in case someone steals it?
When was the last time you heard an alarm up here? I got it.
So, off to Dead Creek, about a 20-minute drive from Middlebury. And on the way, we would do what relatives do this time of year, whether convening to go see a bird or to eat one. We just talked.
So, have you been following all the news? You know, all the fighting in Afghanistan and...
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting. Been going on for years. Slow down, because you're going to go across the traffic that goes that way. You go straight.
Didn't you fight in the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, yeah, me and several hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there by yourself.
Yeah, all alone, I held them up. Yeah, that was sort of cold weather. A lot of snow.
Tell me about Dead Creek. I've been trying to explain it, that it's sort of a resting place where the migratory birds?
Yeah, it's right on the big flyway from north to south. So they flock in there. I've seen geese there you wouldn't believe, but no guarantee this time that they're there. See, the weather's getting colder and they aren't going to hang around.
I know.
They go through sometimes in by the thousands. I saw one day I walked out the backyard. And snow geese are going by. Yeah. They were low, very, very, very low, and they're way back of the house. They were flying single file. And I bet you the line of them was probably 3 football field length.
Really?
That's all I got. I watched this big chain going. It's up over the top of the trees, down, down, down. Never ever seen it since.
Huh.
Sometimes you can hear them coming. All honking away. Sound exactly like that. You want to know?
They do. Okay, Uncle Locke, we just saw a sign, Dead Creek Wildlife Management. And the good news is I see some cars up ahead. I see.
There's a lot of times the geese get out in there. See?
Okay.
Right. There they go. See them?
Yep. All right, now
look at the cars here.
I know.
Well, that means a lot of geese. Look at them out there. See them?
Yep. Let's go up there. Oh, look, there's geese.
At Dead Creek, we met up with my cousins and Brian Pfeiffer, a member of the Vermont Audubon Society, who runs several bird tours.
We're seeing regularly Ross's goose. It's a small version of a snow goose. And people think that we're nuts, you know, because we come out here and we look for one Ross's goose. But it's
give
also...
Name that thing again.
Ross's, R-O-S-S.
Ross's.
R-O-S-S-apostrophe-S.
Yeah, okay.
Ross's goose.
Huh? Yeah.
Small. They're out here.
Yeah, I want to see one now.
Yeah,
see,
so do I.
Yeah.
Hey, but look, I'm looking up there. I'm way up, much higher than the others we've seen. There's a V forming. Are they leaving?
Also, if you look right over the parking lot here is a bird that's hovering. That's a red-tailed hawk hovering. But yes, those birds are leaving. You notice the V formation?
Yeah.
You see how one arm of the V is longer than the other?
Yeah.
They've actually figured out why that is. The longer arm has more geese in it.
Oh my gosh! Hundreds, thousands of them! Uncle Locke, look! Thousands!
Around, yeah.
Something. Here they come.
Wow, this is the best way to look at them.
I will never forget the look on my uncle's face. He'd put on my cousin's cape because of the cold, and when the birds rose up, probably because of that hawk, so did he. It was as if the ground where the snow geese were had been covered with snow, and then someone scooped it all up and threw it in the air like confetti.
One great fall experience. And you had it. I mean, when they all flew over your heads, you know, I mean, that's just, I live for that every fall.
I bet I saw the snow geese one time going by down through Cornwall.
Yeah.
Looked out back, and it was nothing but a thin white line.
Yes.
As far as you could see, and tree height. Far south, you see? Far north.
Okay. We're getting frozen!
That's right.
What'd you think?
Think about what?
The geese.
Oh, pretty nice. Yeah, I've seen millions of them, you know.
I know you have. But I saw the look on your face when that group lifted up.
Oh, it's tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. With weather like this, they'll be taken off out of here. They'll be gone.
Yeah.
When they go, it's like ticking, turning the light off. They're gone.
Yeah. Okay. When you want to get something to eat?
Do I want to get something to eat?
Yeah.
Not particularly. Why, you?
Yes, I do.
A return visit to the Snow Geese of Vermont with my late uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin Field, who passed away in 2004 at the age of 91. I think of him often, especially when I see a line of geese stretched across the sky.
A thin white line, as far as you can see, and tree height. Just wow. One long column of them. When they go, it's like click, turning the light off. They're gone.
As Americans prepare for the biggest shopping day of the year tomorrow, some of us might be seeing and maybe even clicking on a new kind of ad, one that flows in a stream of our friends' photos on Instagram. They are very well targeted and, as a result, surprisingly effective. Ben Brock Johnson covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben. Happy Thanksgiving.
Gobble, gobble, Jerry.
Okay. So what is it that Instagram is doing right? Because I have to say, over the last several months, they've gotten me a number of times. I've either almost bought something that I see on Instagram or I've bought something that I see on Instagram. And it never works for me on Facebook. It doesn't really work for me on Twitter. But for some reason, they are targeting me with exactly what I want.
Yeah, Jeremy, Instagram is really good at this. I've had this experience too. And a big part of Instagram kind of being in your head in this way is that it's owned by Facebook, which is a thing that a lot of people forget, and it seems obvious to say. But there are really two data sets at work here, right? There's the Facebook data set, and then there's the Instagram data set. And when Facebook sort of lays these data sets about you over each other, it actually knows a ton about you. It knows a ton of your likes and interests and behaviors. And they can really combine these data sets, one from your Instagram profile and one from your Facebook profile, so they know a ton about your behavior online and can sort of serve you ads that way.
And I would assume that they know what your friends are buying, and maybe that helps them determine what you might buy.
Absolutely. I mean, this is part of the big data world that we live in. And, you know, it just so happens that part of the design of Instagram makes it really, really, really easy for them to serve you ads in really effective ways.
Because when you look at an ad on Instagram, it looks just like somebody's photo until you actually take a closer look at it. It's not like a little box off in the corner of the screen. It is the whole screen, just like a photo would be on your phone.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about this idea, right? This idea of native advertising, that the thing where advertisements look pretty much exactly like regular content. And on Instagram, you don't really notice the same pair of shoes are following you around, for instance, mm-hmm. like it would elsewhere on the internet, because unlike a web page where you would always see that certain box where the ad is and see the sneakers there, it's all squares. They all look the same. And this is the key difference between the advertising feel of Facebook, which these days feels very cluttered and messy, and Instagram, where it feels more natural. This makes you both more likely to click on something that is an ad and also less likely to remember what's an ad and what is not as you're scrolling. And this is why in the last 3 years, Instagram's global ad revenue has gone from about $500 million to a projected $7 billion in 2018.
I'm glad that you brought up sneakers, because I bought Allbirds after seeing them on Instagram. And whenever I see anybody else with those shoes, it's kind of a newish brand of shoes. They also got it because they saw an ad on Instagram.
Yeah, absolutely. And Instagram is really taking this very specific granular data about what you like and what your friends like, and using that to serve you stuff that it thinks you want or need.
So I'm looking at my Instagram feed right now, and I've got a photo and then an ad for a clothing company I've never heard of. Perfect for travel, it says. Then I've got a photo, a photo, a photo, a photo. Then an ad for Bon Appetit magazine.
Okay, interesting.
Then another photo, 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 photo. Then an ad for Italian wool Blake-stitched shoes. Photo, photo.
You're a traveler
photo.
Who's interested in food.
And sock club. I've got sock club. I know. What is it? Wow.
Well, Instagram does use cookies, right? Just like any other part of the internet, it attaches these text files to your behavior as you move around within apps and on the web. And they use that to serve you advertisements that they hope will be super relevant.
And it's working. Somebody's totally making some money on this.
Well, and the interesting thing, too, about Instagram, right, is that Instagram, you know, everything on Instagram in a way is an advertisement. You're advertising your best life as a user. It's aspirational. And on top of that, you know, regular posts, in quotes again here, are increasingly full of product placement. So in a way, ads on Instagram aren't this additional thing anymore. They're actually everything. They're really woven seamlessly throughout. And the more advertising is hard to identify as advertising, the more the consumer is being manipulated in a way without really realizing it, right? So for an advertiser, that's great. For a user, it's a little murky. And if Instagram becomes this place that's chock full of insidious advertising and other people living these perfect, beautiful lives are telling you that you need to buy something to live yours, what is the psychological impact of that? And I just want to raise this. Last week, the University of Pennsylvania released a study that looked at two groups of grad students who use Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat. The group whose use of those apps was limited to 10 minutes a day for 3 weeks showed significant reduction in depressive behavior and loneliness. Mm. So, Jeremy, once you buy the shoes, you know, put the phone down and go for a walk in those shoes, I guess.
Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thanks again. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you too, Jeremy. Thanks.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I am very thankful for our Thanksgiving staff today. Todd Munt, Marcel Hutchins, Ashley Bailey, Jill Ryan, Chris Bentley, Karen Miller-Medson, Alex Ashlock, Emiko Tamagawa, Savannah Marr, James Trout, Max Lieberman, Jack Lepiarz, and Jackson Mitchell. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Happy Thanksgiving. It's Here and Now.